Let's get rolling now. We start with Jared Dillian, the best-selling financial author and regular guest of this show. Visit him at jareddillianmoney.com. Jared, let's talk a little bit about inflation. Are you still there, sir?
Yeah, for sure. I'm here.
Let's talk a little bit about inflation. Everybody's weighing in on this on the show the last couple of weeks. Some of them are saying it's doom and gloom. Some are saying, we'll wait and see. Where are you on that?
Well, so basically, you know, the estimate for CPI coming into today was 4.7%. And that comes from a bunch of different economists on Wall Street. And the range of estimates came from 4.2% to 5.0%. So we got 5.0%, which is at the upper end of the range. That's a little bit of sticker shock. You know, I heard something during the break about whether the Fed would take this into account into their meeting next week. It's you know, I think the optics of this are starting to get bad now that we have 5% inflation and the Fed still has zero rates and they're doing quantitative easing. This is the biggest divergence between inflation and monetary policy I've seen in my career and probably for decades before that. So they're going to have to do something eventually. And I expect that the chatter about tapering asset purchases is probably going to be picking up in the next couple of weeks.
What's the Fed to do? I mean, does raising interest rates fix this?
Well, it's, you know, the answer to that question is kind of complex. In the short term, no, because what's happened is that inflationary psychology has taken hold and people have come to expect price increases. So you would have to raise interest rates very fast and very high in order to make a dent in this psychology. And the Fed is this very, very slow moving institution. You know, and but even before they raise interest rates, you know, we're doing $120 billion a month in quantitative easing, and they're going to have, it's going to take them a while to taper that. So whatever the Fed plans on doing, they're going to be too slow. And I expect inflation to be going up in the meantime. But the one thing I will say is that the rate of increase of inflation is slowing down. Okay. So it's not picking up speed. It's actually slowing down. So it might not get above 6%, which would be good news.
6%. That does sound like a high number. I was of a mind, I thought that a lot of this inflationary pressure was temporary, that it was supply chain issues, and it was a few other items that have happened that were exclusive to the pandemic. It wasn't going to be long lasting or severe.
That was the, I mean, that's the argument that people have been having in finance for the last 3 or 4 months, is whether the inflation was transitory. Yeah. And if you listen to all the Fed officials, they said, you know, it's transitory. This is going to go away. And the point that I was making and a couple other people was that, you know, we've had a sea change in psychology about, you know, people are coming to expect price increases on stuff. And when people expect price increases, they behave differently. They buy in bulk. They buy faster. They accelerate economic activity. And that's what's happening.
Is some of this also due to the fact that the employees who have been sidelined are saying, you need to pay me more to get me back? Is that driving some of this?
Absolutely. And that's probably the biggest driver is on the wage side, because, you know, wages are sticky. So if somebody was making $12 an hour before, and now they're making $22 an hour, those wages are not going to come down. They're going to stay at $22 an hour, and that's going to get passed along to the consumer. So, you know, just for the sake of example, like if you go out to eat at a restaurant, for sure, there's going to be a new menu in the next 3 to 4 months with price increases. This is going to get passed along.
Was it Chipotle said that their staff is going to get a 4%? Prices are going up 4% because of this. So the $20 meal is now $20.80. And maybe that means you get one less drink, or maybe you don't go out because now it's a $21 bill instead of a $19.59 bill. And you know, you wonder if these are going to be decision points for people at some point.
Yeah, I don't think we're to that point yet. I mean, I think, look, a lot of people have done very well during the pandemic. You know, my business has done very well. There's a lot of people who have done very well. Some people have been hurt by it. But I think that these price increases that we're seeing, at least for the time being, can be easily absorbed. That's what I think.
One last thing. You wrote, inflation is making your retirement 243% more expensive. Now, you wrote that in May of this year. Is the same thing apply? And give me a short answer to what that even means.
Well, inflation has a compounding effect. So, you know, the price increases that we're having today are going to compound over time. And, you know, if you want to retire and you want to have $1 million or $2 million in retirement, if we have a lot of inflation in the next 20 or 30 years, you're actually going to need a lot more than that. So you're going to need to invest in things that keep up with inflation.
And is that equities?
Yeah, for sure it's equities and probably commodities and probably not bonds.
And maybe not bitcoins?
Yeah, that's a different story. Yeah.
Well, we will talk about that another day. Jared, it's nice to talk to you this day. Jared Dillian, the best-selling author and money manager, and jareddillianmoney.com is his website. Thank you, Jared.
Thanks.
Ian Schur joins us, the editor-at-large at CNET. Visit CNET.com. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Thanks for joining me again the other day. You were on with me in the morning one day earlier this week talking about a couple of other topics. It's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on then.
We talked a little bit about the OS for Apple. Let's just talk a little bit about that. You wrote a piece saying Apple hopes iOS 15 can tame the app notification deluge. What's that about?
Yeah, well, you know, the average person apparently gets about 46 notifications on their phone. I don't know about you, but I get like 10 times that much. I admit it partially because I'm crazy. But the interesting thing is that Apple has kind of allowed this to come into our lives, right? There's an app for that also means there's a notification that's going to come with it. And what they're trying to do now is they're saying, look, we realize this is a problem. We're going to try and solve it for you a little bit. And in their software update that's coming up in the fall, right, it's going to be free for iPhones and iPads, what they're going to do is have a new feature that both makes the notifications larger, so for those of us with failing vision, it's easier to read, but also it's going to be that they're going to try and kind of decide which notifications are the most important. So they're going to use a computer program that learns how you use your phone, and it will start saying, okay, this is one that you need urgently, this is one maybe you can wait on, and the ones that it thinks you can wait on, it'll deliver at different times throughout the day as a group. Now, it's not going to do this automatically. It'll ask first, but it's their attempt at trying to kind of solve this problem.
I want to talk to you about Joe Biden revoking Donald Trump's executive orders against TikTok and WeChat. I forgot that I knew he was mad at TikTok, but the federal government took some action against them. And what's changed now?
Yeah, you may remember that last year there was a huge to-do around TikTok and the sense that President Trump at the time wanted to ban them. And he said that it was a security issue, although like many things the federal government has done around security and cybersecurity, they didn't really explain why. They just said it was a problem. So now President Biden has revoked Trump's executive orders and instead said that what needs to happen is there needs to be a security review of any apps that are linked to foreign adversaries and that the government needs to be clear about the national security risk. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. You know, TikTok is still banned from all United States government phones. And a lot of that is just merely because it's based in China. And while there are certainly things to debate about the Chinese government and its and the way that it does intelligence gathering and everything, I think that one of the things he might be trying to push back on is the sense that just because it's Chinese that it can't be trusted.
You know, that's the attitude people generally have. And, you know, if you do trust the Chinese, I was actually thinking about the story about the origin of the COVID-19 virus, and they said,
yeah,
well, maybe it wasn't in a lab, or maybe it was in a lab, but it wasn't pernicious. They weren't trying to weaponize the virus. And then I'll get texts from people saying, you're kidding me. How naive are you? You believe the Chinese. You know, you just can't trust them for anything. And maybe we shouldn't trust anybody for anything, Ian.
Well, it's the new Cold War, right? And I think what's interesting is that for us this time around, you know, back, if you think back 30, 40 years ago, we weren't in a major trade agreement with Russia. right? When we were dealing with the Cold War back then, you know, it was easy to say anything Russian was evil because we didn't have to really deal with them. But almost all of our major technology comes from China. We have an enormous trade relationship with them. And so it creates all sorts of havoc to suddenly say, oh, we're just going to demonize this group of a billion people. And I'm not defending the Chinese government at all, but I am also trying to look at this from a realistic point of view.
Well, is it realistic to expect that going forward we will stop relying on them for ventilators and masks and microchips, that we can start to make those things in the United States?
I think that there is more appetite for it. You may have heard, for example, that the Biden administration just got through an agreement through Congress to fund billions of dollars in more technology manufacturing here in the States. And part of the problem that we have run across many times, and we've written about this on CNET, is that the biggest problem is we don't have the people here. We don't have enough electrical engineers here in the United States to run manufacturing facilities at the rate we need to. So it's not just the fact that, you know, the price of our iPhone would go up in price, which it would. It's also that we need to actually train the right people to be able to do these jobs. And right now, we're just not investing in that.
Are you pleased or surprised that the government was able to seize the colonial ransom that they paid to those hackers?
I was both shocked and then not surprised. You know, this is the first time I know of that a ransom has been re-gotten back or seized back from hackers. But what's interesting this time is that it's, you know, this was all through Bitcoin, which if you look into it, one of the things about Bitcoin is supposedly that it's anonymous. And it's true insofar as you can have a bank account or a wallet, as they call it, and you don't have to tie your name to it. But also the reality is that there are actually companies out there that track all of these different Bitcoin wallets, and known ones actually tie them to different people. Because once you know the number of the wallet and the person who has it, you can start tracking all of their transactions because it's all public anyway. So this is probably what happened, is that these hackers, the government was able to identify where this wallet was, probably in another country with a company somewhere, and they went to that company and they said, hey, do you want to support terrorism? Probably not. Give us back the money. And that's how it went. It's interesting, though, that Colonial said that they paid the ransom, and when they got the money back, they got the same number of Bitcoins back, but it was worth two-thirds of what they paid.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a whole other problem.
Such as the volatility of Bitcoin, but it also appears that the fact that they were able to extract that, it was a bad day the next day on the markets for Bitcoin. It seemed the company lost value. Now, maybe that's just what Bitcoin does on any given day, but maybe it was because people think it's not as impervious as they thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, there's this ongoing conversation about whether Bitcoin is used by the criminal underworld and whether or not it's a place that people use for money laundering and for tax evasion. And I'm willing to bet that there's a percentage of people using it for that, as with any currency. But I think what's happening is, as we saw with the Chinese government starting to lock down on Bitcoin and then the price going bananas after that, I think that there are groups of people who are suddenly waking up to the realities of how Bitcoin works and saying, maybe I should get out of this.
Interesting story. We don't have time today. It's CNET.com about UFOs and money and technology. It's always a pleasure, Ian. We'll visit again another day.
Absolutely. Take care.
Ian Schur is an editor-at-large at CNET. Ted Rossman joins us again here on WGN Radio, senior industry analyst at creditcards.com. Hey, Ted, welcome back to the show. I hope you're well.
I am, yes. Thank you for having me.
So, this is just kind of funny, isn't it? Because during the pandemic, everybody did something good. They were saving their money. They were paying down debt. Now that we're coming out of the pandemic, is that about to change?
It seems like it. Our recent survey found that 44% of U.S. adults are willing to accrue debt in order to treat themselves on something discretionary during the second half of the year. And I want to be careful about how I describe this, because I don't want to come on here and say, well, you can't spend any money and you can't do anything, you can't have any fun. What I am saying, though, is let's think twice before we put that on a credit card. The average rate is 16%. That's really expensive. After a year in which the personal saving rate hit a record high And Americans paid down their credit card debt to the tune of a 17% reduction, according to the New York Fed. I would love to keep that momentum going. And I just would have thought that more people would be splurging out of savings and not just automatically going right back to debt.
Yeah, that's I'm glad you made that last part of the point, because I think when people splurge, is it a splurge if you're paying it from savings as opposed to if you're putting it on your credit card?
It's probably just smart budgeting. You know, that's the other thing, is just designate a certain pot of money out of every monthly budget or every paycheck for these kind of discretionary things. I think that's really the smart way to go. I know there's a lot of temptations to spend right now, and we should get out and enjoy ourselves to some extent. I just don't want people to go overboard. I think that we actually have an opportunity here to write a new story. You know, we don't have to spend exactly as we used to. We don't have to run up all these big credit card bills. Half of people had credit card debt before COVID. Half of them had carried it for at least a year. A third for at least 2 years. It becomes a very persistent problem. So if you've been able to make progress, and a lot of people have, they used their stimulus to pay down debt, they spent less, they really made it a priority, I just wouldn't want to give back those gains. I think there's a way to do it in moderation, you know, spend in moderation and avoid that hefty credit card interest.
44% of U.S. adults said they will take on debt to treat themselves at a rate of about 16% or so coming out of the pandemic. I wonder what it was like before the pandemic. Maybe that's actually a normal number.
A lot of things go back to the way they were. We've seen it so many times before. The financial crisis more than a decade ago was another example. It took a lot longer. You know, really, the downturn was in slow motion, and then the recovery was in slow motion compared to COVID. But eventually, credit card balances did regain their previous high and then some. I just really think people need to be smart about it. Another thing I would bring up here is goods versus services. You know, this surprised me. Goods sales actually did really well last year. People renovated their homes. They bought exercise equipment. They bought TVs and furniture. That is not really slowing down. Services spending is picking up, as we expected. Travel, dining, people are getting back out there. But it does surprise me, you know, not just the debt angle, but also the strength of goods. It's not a movement from goods to services. It's goods and services. Probably a nice thing for the economy, but maybe not for your credit card balance.
Yeah. You mentioned the last time we had the housing bubble crash and everything that came with that. And then maybe like now, you comment on this, the government is encouraging us to spend. Maybe they're not saying pay 16% on your credit card, but they know that's how some people are going to do it. But we've all been trying to spend our way out of this pandemic, and we've been encouraged to do so. Don't you think?
It is a consumer-driven economy for sure. It's roughly 70% of GDP is consumer spending driven. So you might say, in a way, it's kind of the quote-unquote patriotic thing to do. I mean, clearly there was a vested interest in having people spend their stimulus money. From a fiscal stimulus standpoint, it doesn't do quite as much if you save it or if you use it to pay down debt, even though those might be entirely rational, appropriate measures at the household level. I just think that even if the macro trend is going to go back to the way things were, I think you individually could do things differently. I would really advise people to prioritize what matters and cut out the rest. You know, there are probably all things that we could identify that we spent on pre-COVID that maybe didn't mean all that much to us. I just think it's all about making these priorities and make it clear, talk to your spouse, talk to your family, and just kind of figure out, because I just feel like something has to give. We can't get carried away with, I know we're excited and we're thankful that things are getting better, but I just think if you do it all at once, you're going to burn yourself out and burn your credit card out.
I'm still looking at that number, 16%. You said that's the average?
It is. And just to be even more clear, that's actually the average of the low end of the range that issuers offer. So it's really what people with better credit are paying. The higher end averages about 24%. So that's people with lesser credit. So you might say if you're carrying a balance, you're probably somewhere in that 16 to 24% realm. As much as we talk about record low mortgage rates, record low Federal Reserve rates doesn't really extend to credit cards.
Why not? How are those not tied together? That's an interest rate. That's something somebody charges.
Yeah, it has to do with the profit margin. So it is tied at an underlying level. It's tied to the prime rate, which is influenced by the Fed. The thing is, though, the profit margin continues to grow. And banks would tell you, well, it's because it's unsecured debt. We're not sure if people are going to pay us back, especially at a time when jobs and the economy have been in tumult. But that's really what's happened there, is that even at times when the Fed has had rates at zero, the profit margin has crept up. So several years ago, you might have paid 14.5% or 15% on a credit card. Now it's crept up a little beyond 16%, and it could be headed higher in the future. So you've got to make your personal credit card rate as low as possible. Make it zero by paying in full if you can. Maybe take out a 0% balance transfer card. That's something that is rebounding. Those really closed off last year as the economy struggled and risk increased, but that's back in play if you have a credit score, I'll say 700 or above.
What's the best credit card you can get?
So when it comes to interest rates, there is a card from U.S. Bank. It's the U.S. Bank Visa Signature card, that or Visa Platinum, U.S. Bank Visa Platinum, 20 months, no interest on balance transfers and new purchases. That's tremendous. It doesn't offer rewards, but if you have credit card debt, that's your reward, is paying that off without interest for more than a year and a half. Could save you a ton of money in interest. If you do want to go after rewards and you can pay your bills in full, the marketing incentives are really ramping up there. We're seeing 100,000 point bonuses from Chase and Capital One and United Airlines, Marriott, Hilton. I mean, there's been a bonanza of offers. And if you can pay in full, it's great news for you. But if you're carrying a balance, I really think you should prioritize the interest rate, not the travel rewards or the cash back.
Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst at creditcards.com. That's real helpful, Ted. Thanks for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and we've got more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit accusing McDonald's of racial discrimination for steering black franchise owners to underperforming stores. The judge says plaintiffs failed to show that McDonald's treated black store owners differently from non-black owners. A pair of franchisees who run four McDonald's restaurants in Tennessee sued the company, accusing it of placing black franchisees in economically undesirable inner-city locations with high security insurance costs and below-average sales. They also claimed McDonald's denied black owners the same opportunities for growth and financial assistance that it offered white owners. The Holiday Inn Chicago Mart Plaza may be in for a facelift. Cranes reports Chicago developer John Murphy has plans to turn it into a more upscale brand. Murphy is known for redeveloping vintage downtown properties into hotels, and he's leading an effort to acquire the 522-room property at 350 North Orleans for about $23 million. The Holiday Inn Chicago Mart has been closed since early December. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. Today's Business of Food adventure takes us to Bologna, Italy, the heart of the Italian food valley, where I zoomed with Natasha Linhart, the founder and CEO of an export company called Atlante.
And that's the way we pronounce it, Atlante.
I was close. She also pronounces tomato, tomato.
We manage exports of tomatoes from Italy to various countries.
But there's a big problem.
And this could represent a true shortage of products on the shelf.
She warns that all Italian tomato products could be hard to get and real expensive because of a shortage of steel to make cans. And we can look to China for the reason.
The economy in China has picked up. The car industry has picked up in China. So basically, big companies like Tata, China, Tata, India, are just not delivering because they're using the product for themselves in the car industry mostly.
She says the big steel companies are defaulting on their contracts with the Italian packers, and without enough cans, the Italian tomato crop is going to be left to rot.
The product could risk being left in the fields, and that would be a tremendous shame.
Natasha Linhart of Atlante says there's no way to know how long the shortage will last, nor what percentage of the Italian tomato crop is going to be lost. But a tomato shortage is not just an Italian problem.
The American production, which comes mostly from California, is also severely affected due to drought. We might find ourselves with a global shortage of this product.
The Italian tomato harvest begins in about a month and lasts into September. She says the tomatoes have to be canned no more than 36 hours after picking or their quality will suffer. Italy normally processes about 5 million tons of tomatoes, but maybe not this year. At the Chicago Board of Trade, some movement after the WASDE report. That's the USDA report that comes out once a month that tells us about the supply and demand estimates around the world. Soybeans are down 19 cents. Corn is up about 8. And wheat right now is down about a penny and a half. Today's Farm to Your Belly feature is a twofer. National Black Cow Day, which is basically a root beer float with chocolate syrup. And it is National Egg Roll Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us. Let's talk a little bit about this Echo story. Amy, what have you got here?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of an interesting one because this has come up, like Amazon has been talking about the sidewalk, and it's essentially a mesh of internet mesh, which is essentially an internet network, an online network, a Wi-Fi network that's created by a couple of different devices, right? So it's not like we create our hotspot at home and that's ours. This is a couple of different devices that would automatically connect together to kind of create a network. Mm-hmm. And so this is in Amazon devices. You'll see it in the settings of most of your devices under Ring doorbells. And if you have an Amazon Echo, you'll see it called Amazon Sidewalk. It went live on Wednesday and there's some consternation about it. Some consumers are saying, hey, I don't necessarily want to use my internet to boost my neighbor's doorbell or my neighbor's ability to find their keys if they have a tracker tag on them, things like that. Essentially, what they're going for is kind of they're building for what's to come. They're building for the future in which we will have so many more connected devices and we will need increasingly stronger networks to support all of them. So if your device goes down, it can lean on kind of one of these adjacent devices to boost it. That's kind of the easiest way to think about it. But some consumers and consumer, watch groups are saying, well, I don't know. This could be using up to, 500 megabytes of my data each month to help my neighbor with their kitchen timer or something like that. So there is a way to disable it if you want. You can always turn it back on. If you have an Echo speaker, you just go into settings and hit disable on Amazon Sidewalk. And if you use the Ring doorbell, go into the control center and same, just disable and confirm under Amazon Sidewalk. A lot of people in the tech community have been talking about this on two different sides of it. On one hand, it's kind of this exciting step for some people in the technology sector thinking, hey, well, we're going to need this kind of infrastructure as more and more of our devices, even our light bulbs are getting, becoming smart bulbs and we're controlling our thermostats with our phones and things like that. On the other side, there's a lot of data privacy concerns, not so much right now, because right now there's no evidence to suggest that your data could be in danger by having this Amazon Sidewalk feature enabled. But it's a matter of, well, what comes next? What will this enable? And, what other things can kind of slide through? Ring doorbells recently, Ring has a relationship with a lot of law enforcement agencies where your data from your doorbell can be accessed by law enforcement. So that's an example people are looking at where a lot of Ring users didn't realize that was available to law enforcement, things like that. So I think it's kind of I'm on board, but then what kind of a thing that a lot of people are sort of considering.
Well, and I think you've pointed it out well that there's a couple things that are up against it. It's like, hey, everybody, let's all be together as a community and help each other. And that's a nice way to look at it, but if you're asking me to give up bandwidth or maybe compromise my security, good Lord, people are desperate to maintain their privacy on the internet. I think that's a task that's difficult for them to persuade people to compromise on those issues.
Yeah, and the mesh network concept, I think, is a really interesting one. If you like Google mesh networks, it'll get you down an interesting rabbit hole. But the idea of creating a network with a group of devices that would act as a single network mm-hmm. is kind of both exciting
yeah.
and also a little bit like the robots are in charge kind of at the same time.
Yeah, no kidding. 45 seconds here. Talk to me about the surge in consumer prices in May.
Yeah, so we're seeing that up about 5% on average across the board. And a couple of sectors in particular of note, cars and trucks continue to rise, particularly for used ones. That's up 7.3%. And household furnishings and services, that's up 1.3% in May, which is the largest monthly increase since January 1976, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which I thought was a really interesting number. So, you know, a lot of lawmakers say this is temporary. We see inflation, we see prices surge. When we're making any kind of economic recovery, this is going to be temporary. Time will tell.
Well, that's a kind of a theme on the show this week. Thanks, Amy Guth.
Thanks so much.